Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics Iowa style and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin, at the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Good to be with you again, Laura.
Yes, nice to be here.
We have so much to talk about on this broadcast, including your exclusive about what Senator Chuck Grassley's staff says he did not know about the effort in January to subvert a peaceful transfer of power to President Biden, and a possible push to get rid of Iowa's individual state income tax. But we begin with the latest on the coronavirus. The Iowa Health Department announced that the Omicron variant of the virus has come to Iowa. Case involved an Iowa resident under the age of 18. Laura, this was no surprise. We were expecting this to happen.
Yes, every state around Iowa had already identified at least one case of that Omicron variant. So it was only a matter of time before we found it here.
Meanwhile, last week, 105 more coronavirus deaths were reported in the state. That brought to 7,550 the number of people in Iowa who have died from the virus since the pandemic started. And the number of people hospitalized with that virus increased to a new high for the year on this Monday afternoon. 816 people in the hospital with the virus. It is a troubling and potentially very difficult trend.
Yes, and remember that the coronavirus deaths lag the hospitalizations, and then also there's a reporting lag of usually between 2 and 6 weeks between when the death occurs and when that fatality is recorded on the website. So the fatalities just reported in the last week mostly happened in October and November. And so the numbers that we're seeing in the hospital, even in September, October, November, on average, we were losing at least 10 Iowans a day to this virus, and the hospitalizations have increased substantially in the last month. So unfortunately, I expect in the coming weeks, the death toll to rise so that we're probably going to have more than 100 new deaths recorded each week going forward.
Every one of these hospitalization numbers has followed the same pattern over the past year. Those who are hospitalized have not been vaccinated. The latest numbers show 77% of those in the hospital right now in Iowa are not vaccinated. It seems so simple, and yet it's apparently so difficult.
Yes. And if you look at the people, the most severely ill, the people who are in the ICU, it's closer to 80% who are unvaccinated. So it's really the people who are fully vaccinated and ending up in the ICU are people who have those underlying vulnerabilities, many of them nursing home residents. But it's primarily the unvaccinated, and healthcare workers are reporting that the average age of the hospitalized patient is younger. So they're seeing a lot of people in their 40s and 50s and 60s. Last year at this time, when we had the huge surge in hospitalizations, it was still overwhelmingly people over age 65 who were ending up in the hospital, and that is no longer the case.
And yet, here's an interesting thing. Nearly 70% of those 18 and older in Iowa are fully vaccinated, and KCCI-TV reported this afternoon, Monday afternoon, 40% of those who are fully vaccinated have gotten a booster shot. Now, that's an interesting turn of events.
Yes. I mean, I have heard that the demand for boosters has been pretty strong. Unfortunately, I heard from some parents that Hy-Vee was canceling their booster appointments or their appointments for their children. I think they're rushing to get a lot of people the boosters. So, but it does seem like a lot of the people who got vaccinated as soon as they were eligible in March and April have been lining up to get those booster shots. And increasingly, the CDC is saying that that third shot is necessary for someone to be fully protected.
And full disclosure for our audience, you've gotten your booster shot and I've gotten mine.
Yes, I have.
All right, we're good. We can stay on this program. Also, last week, word that the state of Iowa is contracting for 100 traveling nurses and respiratory therapists to be deployed to 17 hospitals around the state. So this is an interesting way to try to get more nurses in during this rise in hospitalizations for the coronavirus.
Yes, I learned about this last Monday morning and spent the better part of Monday or Tuesday of last week tracking this down. It's a mix of nurses and respiratory therapists, and they're being sent to all of the highest level hospitals in the state of Iowa. So the 17 major medical centers, that does include Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames. It does not include most of the community hospitals. So for instance, the Boone or Marshalltown facilities, Fort Dodge, they are not included. And unfortunately, the staffing shortages are an issue at basically every hospital in the state of Iowa. But the major medical centers in Des Moines and Mary Greeley will be benefiting from some of the staffing assistance. And they're really desperate because they have the COVID patients take up a lot of demands of staff time, especially the ones who are in the ICU. And they do have longer ICU stays than people who would normally need intensive care treatment, let's say like after major surgery.
They will be expected to work 60-hour weeks for 6 weeks at pay rates starting at $110 an hour. So there will be money to be made on this.
Yes. And I mean, I heard from a contact of mine who works in one of these hospitals said nothing is boosts morale like working alongside someone making five times your salary. And it's a tricky thing, not just in Iowa, but for hospitals around the country, because there have been people who have left their regular nursing staff jobs to take these traveling nurse contract positions. They're very lucrative. Of course, it's very stressful work as well, long hours for
absolutely
or for 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. But people can make, you know, a year's worth of salary in just a few months of working these traveling nurse contracts. So I learned from one of my nurse contacts here that Iowa-based nurses are not eligible to apply for this because they don't want nurses to be quitting their regular staff positions to try to get this contract.
And here's one of the more interesting stories from last week involving the coronavirus. Lawyers for Governor Reynolds have been arguing in court that she's been too busy with the coronavirus to respond to public records requests this year, and that her decision-making process is shielded from disclosure by executive privilege. Have you ever heard anything like this?
No, and I talked to several attorneys about it because I have a number of outstanding records requests with the governor's office. Just for context, I've filed many, many records requests with all different kinds of state agencies, and including the governor's office for years. And prior to the pandemic, I usually got those records within a month or two. I have not received records for the most part from the governor's office. I have not received records since March of 2020. And so a lot of reporters are in the same boat I'm in, that we have records requests outstanding for 6 months, 12 months, and my oldest is more than 18 months old. The lawsuits that the state is defending against, this is a Utah-based attorney who's part of a big project where they've submitted hundreds of records requests related to the COVID-19 testing programs, the Test Iowa, which was the no-bid contract to create Test Iowa. It involved Utah-based companies. And so this attorney has been seeking records from all of the states that use those companies to do COVID testing. And she submitted these records requests to the governor's office in March of this year. And when she hadn't received anything 5 months later, she filed these lawsuits in August. And then about a week or two after the lawsuits were filed, the governor's office sent her a bunch of records and then said, these cases are moot, and is trying to have the lawsuits dismissed. So the attorney is pursuing the case, saying that the records were provided eventually, but not in a timely manner, that the Iowa open records law doesn't set a firm deadline for when you have to provide records, but it does say that they have to be provided in a reasonable time frame. So the plaintiff is arguing here that this was not provided in a reasonable time frame. And the state is arguing that this case should not be allowed to go forward, because if the governor had to defend against this claim that the records weren't provided in a timely manner, the kind of evidence that they'd have to present to defend against that claim would violate the governor's executive privilege. You'd have to disclose all kinds of information about what she had her staff working on instead of compiling these records requests. So I have not talked to any attorneys who have found this to be a persuasive argument. This is, to my knowledge, this has never been tried before in an open records case. And so I don't really expect this to go anywhere, but we'll see.
I'll pick up that phone later. Laura's phone ringing in the background there. Also this week, word that many of Tyson Foods' 11,000 meatpacking workers in Iowa going to get year-end bonuses that range from $300 to $700. As we know, Tyson went through a very difficult time with the coronavirus in the early going here. So this is a bonus, undoubtedly, for people for putting up with all they had to put up with when they were working there and when they are working there.
Yes. And I mean, I think some people would consider it the bare minimum. But I should say that the Tyson vaccine mandate has been very effective from the perspective of getting their workforce vaccinated. I saw one of the epidemiologists I follow online was saying that of all the 99 counties, the one that's had the lowest number of new cases recently is Buena Vista County. That's where Storm Lake is, and there are several meatpacking facilities there. And Buena Vista was an explosive hotspot in the early months. In fact, they still have the total per capita cases in that county are still higher than anywhere else in the state. They just had such a high portion of the population test positive last year, but they've had so many Tyson workers vaccinated that they've, during this surge that we've been having around most of the state this fall, it's really been more under control in the Buena Vista area. So I thought that was very interesting. And I asked this epidemiologist, could that be partially because of the immunity many residents had from their prior infections? And he didn't think so, because infection acquired immunity does wane after time, just like the vaccination acquired immunity wanes a bit. And so the best protection is being vaccinated, even if you already had the illness last year.
A couple of other coronavirus related stories before we move on. The Iowa Supreme Court issued an order last week that face masks will continue to be required inside all Iowa court-controlled spaces, regardless of a person's vaccination status.
Yes, so this affects all courtrooms and any parts of a courthouse that are controlled by the judicial branch. Now, in some smaller counties, the judicial branch doesn't control all the offices. Many other county offices will be located in that courthouse, and so whatever the county supervisors control are not subject to the mask mandate. But in a lot of counties, that they are. And in general, the Iowa Supreme Court, I would say, has been more cautious during this pandemic than the governor has been. I mean, throughout, they were very slow to resume in-person court hearings and jury trials. They had a mask mandate in place once they did resume in-person trials. And there was a brief period from about May until late August when masks were only required for people who hadn't been fully vaccinated. But then with the Delta wave surge that happened this summer, the Supreme Court issued an order in August that said that you have to wear masks in court-controlled spaces regardless of your vaccination status. And that's what was just extended. So it doesn't matter what the level of community transmission is. It doesn't matter if you're fully vaccinated and boosted. They are wanting everyone in a courtroom or a court-controlled space to wear a mask. And it makes sense if you think about it, because at a trial, I mean, people sitting in the jury box or people sitting in a courtroom, they could spend hours in an enclosed space, and the weather's colder. Those courthouses are often not that well ventilated. So I think it makes a lot of sense to have this mask mandate in place.
And one more note on this. In Ankeny last week, as well as in the Southeast Polk School District, school board there voted to end those districts' mask mandates in spite of, in Ankeny, the superintendent's recommendation that it remain in place. Now, we know that in Ankeny, three board members, new board members, were elected in November. They did not enjoy those mask mandates. They vowed to repeal them. They came through.
Yes, I mean, that was the main issue that they campaigned on, the virus restrictions. And the superintendent was not asking the board to keep the mask mandate in place forever. The superintendent was saying, look, you know, just until the winter break, give people more time to get their kids vaccinated, because not everyone has been able to get both appointments in for their child who's now eligible. I'm talking about the kids who are between the ages of 5 and 11, who only just recently became eligible for the vaccine. So this mask mandate, and it happened overnight. You know, they decided one evening at the school board meeting, and the next morning the mask mandate was gone. So they didn't give the teachers or the school staff any time to prepare really for that. And Southeast Polk, similar story. So I think that with these variants circulating now, I mean, we're going to have a lot of spread in the schools right before families travel and gather in large groups for the over the winter vacation. And so we could have a surge in early January.
Yep. California is facing a bit of a surge now, and the governor announced Monday afternoon that a statewide mask mandate would be reimposed as of this Wednesday around the state for every indoor space. Just a difference in how states are governed. Of course, Iowa has never had a statewide indoor mask mandate.
Yes, that's right. Even last November, when the governor issued a limited mask mandate, there were all kinds of exceptions to that.
Right. It is 14 after the hour. Boy, this zooms by fast wherever you're listening to us. And you are in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart, and she's Laura Bellin. We're here every week at this time to talk politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Laura, very important story that you posted on Bleeding Heartland this Monday afternoon about something that Republican Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley's staff told you about what he did not know until recently about the effort in January to subvert a peaceful transfer of power. This is an important story. Why don't you unwrap it?
So the House Select Committee that's been investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol, they just keep releasing bombshell after bombshell. But a few days ago, they revealed that Mark Meadows, who was the former chief of staff to Donald Trump, had provided thousands of pages of documents to the committee. And one of those was a PowerPoint presentation that outlined options for January 6th. And it was three options for Vice President Pence to abuse his role in at the Electoral College certification and try to find some pretext to keep Trump in power. And the PowerPoint also talked about declaring a state of emergency and the military being involved. And so there has been a lot of follow-up reporting on this PowerPoint, and several reporters based in Washington have gotten hold of it. And The Guardian reported that on January 4th, this PowerPoint was shown to a number of Republican senators and members of Congress. So, of course, I and many others wondered, were Iowa's senators part of that group? Chuck Grassley, as the Senate President Pro Tem, was in a position to be presiding over that Electoral College certification if the vice president was absent. And Joni Ernst, although she doesn't have as much seniority as Chuck Grassley, she is part of the Senate GOP leadership team. So Grassley's office didn't put out a statement on this, but I emailed this morning and I received a reply a little bit later that said that his communications director said that neither Senator Grassley nor his staff were aware of the existence of this PowerPoint until it was reported last week. And he also repeated something that Senator Grassley said in September, that he had no knowledge of a memo written by John Eastman, that was Trump's private attorney, that also talked about scenarios for subverting the transfer of power to Joe Biden. And people had asked in September whether Grassley knew about that memo, and he said that he didn't. The Eastman memo did say that Grassley potentially, if Pence recused himself, could be involved in throwing out slates of electors from some of the states that Biden won. But Grassley says that he didn't know about this PowerPoint, hadn't seen it until its existence was revealed last week.
Now, I know you're getting some feedback from some of your people on the blog site and elsewhere that they don't believe this.
Yes, I mean, many people are skeptical about Grassley's role because on January 5th, there was a flurry of media coverage because Senator Grassley was speaking to reporters and he said, if the vice president isn't there and we don't expect him to be there, he was speaking about January 6th, I will be presiding over the Senate. And people said, wait, what do you mean if he's not there and we don't expect him to be there? And even on that day, January 5th, Grassley's staff were walking back that statement. But people do still question whether the senator was somehow aware of what was being planned and the attack on the Capitol. I will say that Senator Grassley and Ernst, they both voted to certify all the Electoral College votes from all of the states, including all of the states that Joe Biden carried. And so I think it is plausible that he wasn't shown this PowerPoint, that this PowerPoint was shown to the group of senators who were planning to object. So Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, the people who ended up voting on January 6th not to accept some of those Electoral College votes. So I do think it's plausible that Grassley wasn't in the select group that saw the PowerPoint.
And we're going to hear more about this. You heard it first here on Capitol Week, but it's on Laura Bellin's blog site, Bleeding Heartland, and she broke that story late Monday afternoon. Another exclusive you had last week, I want to get to that, and then we'll get to some more political stuff. You ran a piece on Bleeding Heartland that alleged that Iowa State Trooper Ted Benda, who unfortunately died in a single vehicle crash in October, was driving a vehicle rated by a national standards organization as having poor performing headlights. Tell us more about this.
So John Morrissey, who is a freelance writer, he was the guest author and did all the research on this piece. I did double checked his research while I was editing it, but really this was his work, not my work. And soon after that trooper Ted Benda died in that accident, following that accident, John contacted me and he said he had been doing some looking around and these Dodge Chargers that the Iowa State Patrol uses and many law enforcement agencies from around the country use these vehicles have poor performing headlights. And I was surprised to hear that, but they rate better on some other things like acceleration and top speed, but they're not that good in headlights. And he discovered when he was researching the story that vehicle accidents have been the third leading cause of death for law enforcement over the past decade. And a number of those accidents happen at night. The majority do happen at night. And so, of course, headlight performance is very important in preventing nighttime crashes. So It took him a while to get some answers out of the Department of Public Safety, which is part of where the Iowa State Patrol is housed. And the Iowa State Patrol spokesperson said that they haven't received any complaints about the vehicle headlights. But regardless, John published, I mean, he had all the details on the various tests. These headlights are all evaluated on high beam and low beam setting in five different ways for straightaways and for curves. And this Dodge Charger police trim version, the late model that the Iowa State Patrol uses, does have inadequate headlights. Now, I should say they do meet the legal standards that the federal government sets. But so this is not the government saying that they're inadequate. This is a national standards organization that the insurance industry basically funds. But they're very well respected. They do all kinds of crash tests and other tests on vehicles.
So is this simply an item of interest, or is there potential blowback on this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I heard from a reader who said if he were a trooper, he'd want the union, the police union, to go to the department and say, replace these headlights with better models. The headlight technology has improved in recent years, and some of the newer vehicles do have better headlights. Some law enforcement agencies are phasing out this style of vehicle. This is based on a four-door sedan, this Dodge Charger that the State Patrol uses. And some of the law enforcement agencies around the country are purchasing vehicles that are more modeled on SUVs, and many of them have better performing headlights. So I haven't heard of any blowback. I know that John is working on pursuing this story further, and so maybe in the next month or two, I'll be publishing some other work by him, depending on what he's able to uncover.
Okay, and we'll be talking about it here on Capital Week. Let's delve back into politics. Democratic State Auditor Rob Sand confirming last week he is going to seek a second term. In his current office, he had been considering running for governor. Why did he decide not to?
Well, he said that he decided not to because he enjoys the work he's doing. And I think he probably does enjoy the work he's doing. I think most political observers expected Rob Sand to run for governor if he thought that he had a good chance of winning. And so I think whenever anyone considers running for higher office and decides against it, you have to assume that they were thinking probably the chances of winning are not going to be great. I mean, with Joe Biden's approval rating in the 30s in Iowa, it's looking like a tough year to try to defeat a Republican incumbent. And so just the odds are much better that he would be reelected. Not necessarily a sure thing, but I mean, the odds of winning a statewide election are better if you're an incumbent than if you're someone running against an incumbent. So I think that's probably the calculus. But he did say that he really enjoys, he's proud of the work the state auditor's office is doing. And I do think he enjoys the work. I mean, I've seen him when he goes out at some of these public appearances and talks up what the auditor's office is doing. And I think he genuinely is excited about some of their projects. So, but I also believe that if he thought he had a good chance of becoming governor, he probably would be running for governor.
Right. And the most recent Des Moines Register poll on this showed that Governor Reynolds is really in a pretty good position to be reelected next year.
Yeah. So her approval rating is a little bit above 50%. I mean, compared to a lot of other governors, it's not a great approval rating, but it is still the political campaign consultants. They look at whether somebody is above that 50% mark or below. And her approval, disapproval numbers, she's in positive territory as the incumbent. I mean, you have a lot of advantages anyway. She has the ability to make news anywhere she goes. She doesn't even have to spend campaign dollars doing that. She has very high name ID. It's looking like it's probably going to be a good election for Republicans. Usually the midterm is good for the party out of power in Washington. So just generally speaking, I would say that she's strongly favored to be reelected.
In another announcement last week, Republican Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagy confirmed he's going to seek re-election. There was no surprise there.
No, I mean, he's been gearing up to do that. And I don't think anyone was surprised. There's not a declared Democratic candidate in that race. John Norwood told me that he's thinking about it. That's the only Democrat I know of who's seriously thinking about running against Mike Nagy. So Mike Nagy has been the Secretary of Agriculture since early 2018. He was appointed to that position after the previous office holder, Bill Northey, left to take a job in the Trump administration's USDA. So Mike Nagy, he won a tough Republican primary. He didn't actually win it outright in the primary. He was nominated at the state convention in 2018. Then he won in November of that year. And the Farm Bureau and other big ag interests spent a lot of money trying to elect him. So I think he would also be pretty strongly favored to be reelected.
But there was a surprise last week, wasn't there? Because Republican State Senator Robbie Smith launched his campaign for state treasurer. He wants to run against Democrat Mike Fitzgerald, who's only held the office for 40 years. Now, that was a surprise.
Mike Fitzgerald is not only the longest serving state treasurer in Iowa history, he is the longest serving state treasurer in U.S. history. And he confirmed that he is going to be running for an 11th term. And the Republicans have not put up strong candidates against Mike Fitzgerald. I mean, they've always nominated someone, but I went and looked up after Robbie Smith announced his campaign. I went and looked up the campaign finance disclosure forms from the 2018 race. It was actually a candidate based in Ames who was the Republican challenger against Mike Fitzgerald. His name was Jeremy Davis. He raised about $24,000 in that entire race for a statewide race. So they really haven't challenged Mike Fitzgerald in a serious way. And I'll be looking closely in January when the first campaign finance disclosures are due to see whether Robbie Smith has some serious backing from Republicans, because this is a race that Mike Fitzgerald is well-liked. He's well-known. And it's not been something, I mean, he survived some Republican wave elections before. He was reelected in 1994, 2010, 2014. So I think that the race is probably his to lose. But if Robbie Smith can demonstrate that he can raise a few hundred thousand dollars and really get out there and lift his name ID, you know, who knows? I mean, it just, again, and it's a midterm election and it could be good for Republicans. But right now, Robbie Smith is not well known outside the Quad Cities area, other than to people like me who follow legislative happenings closely. So it would be a tall order, I think, for him to be the state treasurer.
We have about 3 minutes left, and we want to talk about something the Des Moines Register is reporting, that Senate Republicans in Iowa want to at least take the first steps next year in the next legislative session to get rid of the state's individual income tax because the state has a budget surplus. So what are the odds on this actually happening?
Well, the surplus, a lot of the surplus comes from the federal coronavirus aid that's been pouring into the state. And that has an end date on it. I mean, the American Rescue Plan is bringing a lot of money to Iowa. Obviously, the CARES Act did last year. But after 2024, 2025, that's going to be gone. So making permanent tax changes on the basis of a temporary surplus is a little bit dicey. And what we've seen in the last few years in the legislature, even though it's been a Republican trifecta, the Senate Republicans and the House Republicans have often been at odds on the details of tax policy. And in general, the Senate Republicans are much more aggressive about the cuts they want. So last year, I mean, one of the reasons the legislative session went into overtime was because the House Republicans didn't agree to most of what was in the Senate Republican tax plan. So I think that phasing out the income tax probably is not going to happen. I think some sort of income tax cut that's skewed toward wealthy taxpayers and corporations probably will happen. But on the House side, there will be some people in that caucus and the appropriations chair, especially, he's expressed a lot of concern about making permanent changes because it has to be sustainable 4 or 5 years down the road when this federal money isn't coming into the state, at least not to the same degree.
They're already starting to write our script for next year on this show, aren't they? That would be fun. Yeah. All right. A couple of minutes left. A report from the U.S. Department of Justice last week that concluded the state of Iowa has violated the legal rights of people with intellectual disabilities by housing too many of them inside institutions. What do we make of that?
So in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a real trend against these big, large institutional centers of care for people with developmental and intellectual disabilities. And Iowa has reduced the population somewhat, but not nearly as much as other states. And I talked to a few people in the disability advocacy community last week about this report after Tony Lays wrote about it in the Des Moines Register. And by the way, Tony Lays' coverage has been outstanding of everything going on at Glenwood Center these last few years and the problems relating to the care there. The issue is, although a lot of advocates for people with disabilities say that it is better, ideally, for most people to be living in the community, living at home and getting home-based services, Iowa really doesn't have the support network set up for that. So unfortunately, I mean, we're stuck in the situation where we should probably have less people in the institutions. But right now, if you emptied out those institutions, we don't have the resources to really give those people the care they need at home either. The salaries for the home-based healthcare people are just rock bottom in Iowa.
Right. We have 20 seconds left. What do you expect this week, Laura? I know, expect the unexpected. Is there anything in particular?
Oh, I just think there's always a lot going on this week. I'm going tomorrow to the Summit on Justice and Disparities, and I'm hoping to be able to report back from that. That's something that the NAACP and others organize. I'm hoping to be able to report on that next week.
I think you'll be able to. Well, that's it. And you have a great week, Laura, okay?
Thank you.
We are out of time. You have been listening to Capital Week on KHY Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will Zoom right back here in this time slot next week, we promise, with a look at the latest political activity in Iowa and what it means for all of us. There's always a lot of activity. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. Between now and next time, we hope you have a great week.